Peter B. Collins News and Comment. It's Wednesday, August 2nd, 2017. I've got a lot of news to comment on today. Thanks for clicking and listening. My lead story today is kind of a footnote in most of the corporate media. Yesterday, the United States Senate confirmed the new director of the FBI for a 10-year term, unless Trump fires him, by a vote of 92-5. And once again, not only was Bob Mueller canonized in this manner, but so was Jim Comey. And what we have is a pattern where the Senate does not exercise its critical constitutional role to advise and consent. And Chris Wray was a lawyer for Chris Christie. He helped him keep the lid on the Bridgegate scandal, and Chris Christie did not get indicted. I didn't hear any questions senators asked to Mr. Wray in the confirmation hearing, which was quick, and they basically just wanted to establish that he hadn't pledged any loyalty to Donald Trump. And I'm sorry if you get tired of me saying this stuff repeatedly, but this is the only opportunity for the Senate to grill an FBI director before he takes the job and get him on the record about the Patriot Act, about the national security letters, about the 15,000 paid informants who were framing on a frequent basis Islamic Americans for alleged domestic terrorism crimes. None of this was aired out. And there are many other issues about the management of the FBI, about the creeping police state, about the FBI's interaction with the Joint Terrorism Task Forces, and the way we have vertically integrated law enforcement in this country. But none of that was discussed, and this guy has been confirmed, and now we're stuck with him. And with a 92-5 vote, that means there are only five senators who can say, you know, I wasn't quite sure about that guy. The rest of them? Well, when Chris Wray disappoints them, they will have nobody to blame but themselves. Today, the San Francisco Chronicle published an op-ed by yours truly entitled Plenty of Solutions Exist for Easing Chronic Backups. And if you don't live in the Bay Area, you probably don't care about this, and that's fine. But if you do, I encourage you to help me in my personal quest to get the Golden Gate Bridge District to stop the madness. What happens is tourists clog up the bridge trying to get to the Vista Point, which is at the north end of the bridge. And when the parking lot fills up at the Vista Point, the cars just back up onto the bridge. And it creates these huge weekend backups. And the bridge blames the Transportation Department or the Highway Patrol. It's this Three Stooges game. And I'm fed up, so I wrote this op-ed. I'm grateful that the Chronicle published it. And if you happen to have seen the op-ed and listened to the podcast today for the first time, welcome. They published at the end of the article, Peter B. Collins, veteran radio host, podcast at peterbcollins.com. So I hope there's a whole wave of Bay Area listeners who said, where did that guy go? Whatever happened to Peter B.? Well, he's right here behind this podcast every day, and you have found it. Now, I want to take some time here to listen to and comment on a piece of audio that surfaced late yesterday. It is clearly the voice of Seymour Hersh, the Pulitzer Prize-winning investigative reporter who's in his late 80s, if not early 90s. And Hersh, of course, most recently distinguished himself with a piece of journalism where he challenged the public narrative about the alleged use of chemical weapons in Khan Shukun in Syria. I think it was on April 4th. And Hersh did a great job of debunking what I think was a concocted story. And in this, what appears to be a purloined audio tape, I'm going to link to the file that's up at YouTube so you can listen to it for yourself. And I edited out some of the most rambling parts. When you hear Seymour Hersh, he's got the vocabulary of a sailor. He's quite profane. And he also interrupts himself a lot and kind of adds additional detail. But you'll get the gist of what he's saying. He opens by talking about Seth Rich, the staffer at the Democratic National Committee whose murder remains unsolved and who we are told not to spin conspiracy theories about. Here's the voice of Cy Hirsch.
About the kid, and I'll tell you what I know. What I know comes off an FBI report. Don't ask me how you can figure out. I've been around long enough. The kid gets, I don't think he was murdered. I don't think he was murdered because of what he knew. The kid's a nice boy, 27. He was not an IT expert, but he learned stuff. He was a data programmer, but he learned stuff. He's living in a very rough neighborhood. And in the exact area was where he'd been, there's been about 10, I'm sure you know all this, there's been about 8 or 9 or 10 violent robberies, most of them with somebody brandishing a gun. And it's his hands, I'm telling you, but I'm sure you know, his hands were marked up. The cops concluded he fought off the people, tried to run, and they shot him twice in the back with a .22, small caliber. And then the kids that did it ran, they got scared, didn't take his wallet. Okay, so what the cops do then, and here's what nobody knows, what I'm telling you. When you have a death like that, D.C. cops, if you're dead, you generally don't just go, you have to find out what's going on. You have to get to the kid's apartment and see what you can find. If he's dead, you don't need a warrant, but most cops get a warrant because they don't know if the guy has a roommate. You need a warrant. So they get a warrant. They go in the house and they can't do much with his computer, his password. The cops don't know much about it. So the D.C. cops, they have a cyber unit in D.C. and they're more sophisticated. They come and look at it. The idea is maybe he's had a series of exchanges with somebody who says, I'm going to kill you, motherfucker, over a girl. And they can't get in. The cyber guys do a little better, but they can't make sense of it. So they call the FBI cyber unit. The D.C. unit, the Washington field office, is a hot shit unit. The guy running the Washington field office, he's like a three-star at an army base. He's ready looking for four. You know what I mean? He's going to go with a top job. There's a cyber unit there that's excellent. What you get in a warrant, the public information you get in a warrant doesn't include the affidavit underlying why you're going in, what the reasons are. That's almost never available on. I can tell you that. On the same warrant, they call in the Fed. The Feds get through, and here's what they find. This is according to the FBI report. He makes, first of all, you have to know some basic facts. One of the basic facts is there's no DNC or Podesta email that exists beyond May 22nd, May 21st, 22nd. It's the last email from either one of those groups. And so what the report says that sometime in late spring would be after, I presume, I don't know, I just say it says late spring, early summer, he makes contact with WikiLeaks. That's in his computer, and he makes contact. Now, I have to be careful because I met Julian in Europe, Julian, 10, 12 years. I say the fuck away from people like that. You know,
He's referring to Julian Assange, and in case that was garbled, he said, I stay the fuck away from people like that.
He said, invited me, and when I'm in London, I always get a message, come see me at the Ecuadorian ambassador, and the fuck you, I'm going there. I got enough trouble without getting photographed by every fucking age. He's under total surveillance by everybody. But anyway, they found what he had done. He had submitted a series of documents, of emails, some juicy emails from the DNC. And, you know, by the way, all this shit about the DNC, whether hacked or wasn't hacked, but whatever happened, the Democrats themselves wrote this shit. You know what I mean? All I know is that he offered a sample, an extensive sample, you know, I'm sure dozens of emails, and said, I want money. That later, WikiLeaks did get the password. He had a Dropbox. Protect the Dropbox, which isn't hard to do.
So that's a very interesting wrinkle, introducing the idea that Seth Rich may have leaked material to WikiLeaks in search of money. Now, that's a motive that people have never really examined before, but it's one that bears a deeper study, in my view.
Also shared this box with a couple of friends. So if anything happens to me, it's not going to solve your problem. Okay? I don't know what that means.
So he just says that Seth Rich set up insurance programs. He gave the password to the Dropbox to friends in order to protect him because dealing with WikiLeaks, you have no idea who's on the other end. Where are the people who hold the insurance policies?
I don't know whether he was. Anyway, But WikiLeaks got access, and before he was killed, I can tell you right now, Brennan's an asshole. I've known all these people for years. Clapper's sort of a bitter guy, but not rocket scientist. The NSA guy is a fucking moron. And they, you know, the trouble with all those guys is that the only way they're going to make it to a board or two and get, you know, hired by SAIC to deliver some fat cat contracts is if Hillary stayed in. With Trump, they're gone. You know, they're done. They're going to live in their pension. They're not going to make it. I have somebody on the inside. You know, I've been around a long time, and I write a lot of stuff. I have somebody inside who will go and read a file for me. This person is unbelievably accurate and careful. He's a very high-level guy. He'll do a favor. You're just going to have to trust me. I have what they call in my business long-form journalism. I have a narrative of how that whole fucking thing began. It's a Brennan operation. It was an American disinformation. And fucking the fucking president, at one point when they even started telling the press, they were back-briefing the press. The head of the NSA was going and telling the press, this fucking cocksucker Rogers, was telling the press that we even know who in the GRU, the Russian military intelligence service, leaked it. I mean, all bullshit. They were telling these two. I worked at the New York Times for fucking years, and some of the fucking New York Times that they have smart guys, but they're totally beholden on sources. If the president or the head of the CIA tells them something, they actually believe it. Hey, I was hired at the Times to write about it, to go after the war, in the Vietnam War in 72, because they were just locked in. So that's what the Times is. These guys run the fucking Times. And Trump's not wrong. I mean, I wish he would calm down and had a better press secretary. They don't have to be so. Trump's not wrong to think they all fucking lied about it.
Trump is not wrong to think they all fucking lied about this. Now, that's definitely the voice of Seymour Hersh. There is no doubt about that. I'm not sure why this audio recording has been leaked or made available. I'm not sure which. And I would hope that Seymour Hersh is working on an article or a book based on what he described as his narrative of these events. Now, the language we heard was Scaramucci quality, wasn't it? I mean, I've interviewed Hersh once before, and he does ramble, but he kept it clean when he talked to me. It's fascinating to hear this line of reasoning. And let me be really fair. The critical comment came from Cy Hersh toward the end there. He said, "You have to trust me." And that's what this boils down to. I'm not offering this as evidence. I'm saying that this is an analysis. This is a point of view. This is a possible scenario of what occurred, or pieces of a possible scenario. And I think it bears consideration. I think that Seymour Hersh has the credibility to earn our trust, where the Trump-Russia narrative advanced by the New York Times, Washington Post, Democratic leaders embraced by MSNBC and Rachel Maddow, well, it's a trust me narrative as well. And I find the lack of evidence being offered and the way that this has been manipulated, it drives my skepticism. And my bias is in favor of something along the lines of what Seymour Hersh is suggesting. Now, more recently, we've learned about Imran Awan, who was working for Debbie Wasserman Schultz as an IT consultant. And I believe we need a full investigation there to see what, if any, connections he had to the efforts to keep Bernie Sanders from winning the Democratic nomination last year, the rigging of the primaries. What did Imran Awan know about the leaks at the DNC and the efforts to plug them? What did he know about the generation, possibly fabrication, of this whole blame Russia narrative? And the idea that Seth Rich might leak in exchange for money. Again, this is not something that has been suggested, at least to my knowledge, by anybody, a financial motivation for these leaks. So, I'm sorry if this creates more questions than answers. It does. But, as you know, I am willing to believe the official narrative when the evidence is presented and when the leakers come out and identify themselves. And if that's the case, I will, right here behind this microphone, tell you that I have changed my tune. But I'm presenting for your consideration a great piece published yesterday by Mike Whitney at Counterpunch. Headline is a question. Did Hillary scapegoat Russia to save her campaign? And based on the work of the Veterans Intelligence Professionals for Sanity, quotes from Ray McGovern's recent interviews, Whitney makes the case that this is an entire fabrication and that it was intended to divert attention from the content of the leaks, which included the evidence of rigging the primaries against Bernie Sanders. And in my view, I've said this before, there was money laundering going on with the treasurer of Hillary's campaign able to maneuver funds that were raised that were supposed to go into state party accounts, supposed to go into local congressional campaigns, that instead were misappropriated and used to benefit Hillary. And, of course, the DNC was not permitted to favor one candidate over another, or at least it shouldn't, until after the primaries were over. And I think that the financial maneuvering is something that will eventually surface and will be a significant aspect of all this. But Mike Whitney points out that the FBI still has not gained access to the computers at the DNC. And he says, hey, you know, these computers are Exhibit A in the trial of the century. They should be under lock and key at FBI headquarters. He also notes that the FBI has never made an attempt to interview Craig Murray, Julian Assange's associate, who has flatly said that he was a recipient of some of this leaked information. He received it in person in Washington, D.C. And Murray, who's a former British ambassador to a former Soviet republic, I find credible, and at minimum, his information should be collected and shared. But this is what fuels my skepticism about these issues, and I hope that you'll continue to keep your mind open and to ask the critical questions as we continue to be buffeted by this incredible narrative. Brad Friedman of Bradblog reports on the DEF CON convention that was held in Las Vegas last week, and they brought in a sample machine of every electronic voting system that is used in the United States, the touchscreen voting machines, so-called DREs, the electronic optical scanners, and other equipment that is used to tabulate the votes. And within hours, every single system was hacked. And another article that I found online at a place called The Register, it took DEF CON hackers minutes to own these U.S. voting machines, and they explain machine by machine. Let me just take you for one example here. From Diebold to Sequoia to WinVote equipment, the equipment was bought on eBay or from government auctions, and they brought this stuff and turned the hackers loose on it. Here is a WinVote machine. It took a minute and 40 seconds for Karsten Sherman to get remote access to a particular machine. So this really, in a cartoon way, shows the vulnerabilities of our election system. And certainly Russia could have hacked. I believe Russia may have hacked, but I never have been persuaded that Russia hacked and grabbed the data from the DNC and fed that to WikiLeaks. And it's inconclusive, the efforts by alleged Russian hackers to enter registrars of voters and other voting facilities here in the United States. And we've heard a wide array of reports about that, none of which I find particularly accurate. And I want to note that our friend and colleague, activist Ray Lutz in San Diego, he's been campaigning to decommission the San Onofre nuclear power plant and to keep the spent fuel from being kept on the site there. And in his spare time, Ray has filed a lawsuit as the founder of Citizens Oversight Project to gain access to all of the ballots from the Democratic primary in 2016 in San Diego County. Lutz says he suspects that Bernie Sanders received more votes than Hillary Clinton and should have won the Democratic presidential primary. So to check, he wants to access the county's reams of ballots. And the county says state law seals the ballots and they can't be released to Lutz or other members of the public. Well, I hope Ray wins that legal battle. And I'd love to see if there is forensic evidence of manipulation of the vote count. One of the pieces of evidence he uses is the disparity between the precinct votes and the mail-in ballots, the absentee ballots. Well, we did get confirmation from the White House. Sarah Huckabee Sanders told the media yesterday that Trump, in fact, did participate in the drafting of the misleading statement that was used by Don Trump Jr. In the first round of trying to explain the meetings with Russians at Trump Tower last June. And this is not a big surprise based on what we had learned from the leaks to the Washington Post. But for the White House to confirm it, and I don't know about you, but whenever I watch Sarah Sanders, her lips start to move, and I don't believe what comes out. But here's what she said yesterday. The president weighed in, as any father would, based on the limited information he had. He certainly didn't dictate, but like I said, he weighed in, offered suggestion like any father would do. Now, I am really tired of this idea that the Trump family is selflessly devoting itself to public service. And I have no sympathy for Don Jr., who was in way over his head participating in a presidential campaign. And the idea that Daddy, who is being accused of obstruction of justice, would get involved in this effort to massage, to spin up, to minimize the account. That's another act of obstruction of justice. And this is what is so maddening, is that Trump's ego, his narcissism, his sense of just how smart he is, it leads him to create these situations where he may be impeachable. And this produces this grotesque possibility that Trump could end up being removed for office for obstructing justice in the investigation into non-existent Russian efforts to manipulate our election. I mean, this is just a very complex spy novel that is unraveling before us. And all of this has led Trump to sign the sanctions bill, which is aimed at North Korea, Iran, but primarily Russia. And it has unprecedented language. He left a signing statement that there are a number of clearly unconstitutional provisions. I'm not sure I would go that far, but I think it's inadvisable to have a sanctions bill here that ties the president's hand and requires him to come back to Congress to reduce or eliminate the sanctions. And I also think that the basis for these sanctions is the unproven claims, the hysterical claims driven by the Democrats who looked for an excuse for Hillary's loss, looked for an excuse to distract people from the content of those emails last summer, which surfaced so inconveniently right before the Democratic convention. And Trump sucked it up. He said, "I'm signing this bill for the sake of national unity. It represents the will of the American people to see Russia take steps to improve relations with the United States." You don't impose sanctions on a country you're hoping to improve relations with. It's just crazy. And the sanctions are really pissing off the Germans. Their economic minister on Monday, her name is Brigitte Zipries, told a newspaper, "We consider this as being against international law, plain and simple. We don't want a trade war, but it's important that the European Commission now looks into countermeasures. The Americans cannot punish German companies because they operate economically in another country. At issue here is Russia's Nord Stream 2 pipeline that will deliver natural gas to a distribution hub in Germany." And this is inference on my part, but it appears the Germans see this as a sanction law that would actually benefit American exports of natural gas. Because the prospect is that we could supply gas to this hub in Germany instead of the Russians. Now, there's much more I would need to know before I would take that and run with it, but it is an interesting perspective, and I think it's worth noting. Every day I like to pause for a second and thank the people who support my work here at the Peter B. Collins Podcast with your subscriptions. People like Cynthia Von Hendricks, Abby McMillan, Paul Tomaselli, and Lauren Howard. Lauren just renewed her annual subscription. I think this is the fourth or fifth year, Lauren. Thank you for your loyal support to the podcast. It means a lot to me. And I invite you, if you're not a subscriber, become one. You can fix it in less than 3 minutes. You go to peterbcollins.com. Find the menu, a tab, you click on that, then click on Become a Subscriber. It moves you to the sign-up page, and that's where you can make choices that fit your budget. Well, Rexon Tillerson crawled back from Texas to let us know that he is still playing the Secretary of State. He gave an interesting press briefing where he walked back from America's promotion of democracy around the world. And on the one hand, I would like to deplore that because we should be promoting democracy. But our alleged efforts to promote democracy have been compromised, have been really wholesale changed to promote our version of democracy, which often is really driven by American imperial interests. And I think Ukraine is the best recent example of this. So I'm waffling on this, and I'm admitting it, because I wish that we had a true dedication to the promotion of freedom and democracy. But these are terms that are Orwellianly used, and I know that's not a word, to really twist the meaning of freedom and democracy to promote America's imperialist interests. So beyond that, Rexon Tillerson also said, in remarks that I think were coordinated by the White House, he basically is threatening a trade war with China if China will not put pressure on North Korea to stop its nuclear and its ICBM tests. And I think that this is a real boneheaded move. This is driven by Trump's incorrect belief that China can force North Korea to fall in line. And China doesn't want to do that for various regional reasons, and I don't believe that the North Koreans would really respond anyway. But this draws quotes to the Guardian newspaper from Orville Schell, a man I know. He used to be dean of the UC Berkeley School of Journalism. He is a China expert. He's written several books about it. He now runs the Asia Society in New York. He said that Tillerson's comments were a polite way of saying that we are increasingly estranged. There are now a number of signals that suggest we may be ineluctably on diverging paths. And after the article introduces similar comments to Tillerson's by Wilbur Ross, who is the Commerce Secretary, he used a column in the Wall Street Journal to threaten China, saying we'll use every available tool to counter the protectionism of those who pledge allegiance to free trade while violating its core principles. Then they returned to Orville Schell, saying numerous issues on which Trump had hoped to see friendly resolution, including North Korea, were now festering into a state of increased antagonism between the U.S. and China. If they could have found some convergence, I think Xi would have walked away with the South China Sea, the bases they've built in the so-called Spratly Islands. There wouldn't have been any trade war. There would be no comment on Hong Kong or Taiwan. But he missed that one, and now we see Trump starting to turn on him. I think that we're at more than a tipping point. We are at a turning point. If you don't see evidence that engagement is working, then you have to say, okay, then what? Are we back in the Cold War? Where are we? Asks Orville Schell. Well, in terms of Afghanistan, we can kiss off another $500 million, to be precise, $457 million. That's how much we squandered on Pentagon-funded programs to develop the intelligence capacity of the Afghan Defense and Security Forces. And the Inspector General has just concluded that this has been a total waste. And only 47% of the intelligence sites that the U.S. established are ready to transfer to the Afghan government. And we know that the rampant corruption there probably put most of that $457 million into the pockets of people like former President Hamid Karzai and his cronies and his brothers, who are his cronies. Bernie Sanders is ramping up. He's got some ads that are running, paid for by his campaign and replenished by supporters who kicked in $65,000 to a crowdfunding effort yesterday. He is announcing a plan for Medicare for All, single payer. And I'm really distressed because the Guardian newspaper from London, which often has good coverage of American issues, the editors chose to insert some really inaccurate language into this article. It reads, Sanders is ready to introduce his own solution, government-run universal health care for all Americans. A couple of graphs down, Sanders has been a longtime advocate of the single-payer system, government-run universal health care. And the plan was at the heart of the left-wing populist agenda that fueled his unexpected rise during the primaries last year. Now, single-payer is not government-run universal health care. It is government-run health insurance. Medicare doesn't hire doctors. It pays them. Medicare doesn't control hospitals. It pays their bills. And so this is the kind of poisoned rhetoric which is so rampant in the corporate media today, and it drives me up a wall. Here in California, the Covered California Obamacare Exchange that covers 1.4 million Californians, including me, has announced average rate increases of about 12.5% next year. For whatever reason, the county I live in is only 7.5%. But there is a 3% potential surcharge because of the uncertainty in Washington. And as Trump tries to kill Obamacare, they may have to increase rates because of the instability of the markets. This is infuriating because he is intentionally interfering in my ability to get health care, decent health care, at a price that I can afford. And members of the Republican Party in Congress are abandoning Trump's call to continue to try to kill Obamacare. Lamar Alexander, the senator from Tennessee, says that in early September, he will work on legislation to stabilize and strengthen the individual health insurance market. That's what I'm a part of. And lawmakers from both parties concede that the health law needs improvement. It's a matter of what improvements they can agree upon. And that, of course, will be the rub. Thanks for joining me today for my daily news and comment podcast. We distribute this one free, and you're free to share it far and wide. It's also available every day on YouTube, so spread the word about that, too, will you? I'm Peter B. Collins.
Happy trails to you until we meet again. Happy trails.